Okay, should probably make a start. Okay. So,
the microphone is off.
I think it's on,
but it's
might be not in the best place. I've got a new shirt on today, you see. Thank you.
Is that any better?
Anyone?
Oh, I don't know. Might do. I'll try. If you can't hear me at any point, just sort of wave frantically or shout out something.
Okay, so an announcement before we start. So there will be tutorials next week. That'll be the last tutorial. But there's no actual tutorial sheet for them because we're getting to the stage of term where we're not kind of piling on new material, serious new material that you're expected to assimilate. So the lectures from this week, they're sort of, in principle, examinable, but only in a rather kind of soft way. You might get some multiple choice questions about them, but you won't have to roll up your sleeves and apply serious techniques. So instead, for the tutorial next week, what I thought we'd do is, if you look at last year's exam and have a go at some of that, I'll send out a message giving you a pointer to where you can find last year's exam. Have a go at some of the questions, and there'll be opportunities to go over that you got stuck with. So moving into kind of general revision mode rather than fresh material mode. Okay. So, okay, so last time we looked at, well, the top two levels of the Chomsky hierarchy, really, in terms of the kinds of grammars that we need to talk about them. We looked at context-sensitive grammars, context-sensitive languages, and then unrestricted or general grammars, where we didn't have that little restriction on the lengths of the left and right-hand sides. So now what we're going to do today is focus on the kinds of machines that they correspond to, the kinds of machines that you'd need to recognize languages at that level. So a bit of summary of where we've got up to with our understanding of the Chomsky hierarchy. Then I'll tell you about two classes of machines, the general class of Turing machines, and a slightly when that corresponds to the unrestricted grammars in the top level of the Chomsky hierarchy, and then a slightly more restricted thing called linear bounded automata that corresponds to context-sensitive grammars. And then we'll look briefly at some of the reasons why all this is stuff about Turing machines is interesting, the idea that they kind of capture the limits of what can be computed by mechanical procedures in general. So we'll say something about that. Okay. So here's a sort of summary slide. In some sense, this is probably the most important slide in this lecture, so I recommend you pay some attention to this, because in some sense, this summarizes all the bits of the formal language side of the course and how they fit together. So we've got the Chomsky hierarchy here, kind of upside down with the lowest level at the top. Yeah, because it's just convenient. So we saw that we had regular languages, and the corresponding kinds of machines for those can be either NFAs or DFAs. And we saw, remember, just at the start of when we were talking about context-free grammars, we pointed out that if all your rules are of this kind of particular restricted form, either a single terminal going to another non-terminal, or the empty thing, or just one non-terminal writing to another, if all your grammar rules are of that kind, you can call it a regular grammar, and regular grammars correspond exactly to regular languages. It's quite easy to translate between regular grammars and NFAs, as we discovered. And then going up, we have context-free languages, and that's where you're allowing rules with a single non-terminal on the right-hand side, but any combination of terminals and on the left-hand side, single non-terminal, any combination of terminals and non-terminals on the right-hand side. And the machines corresponding to those were non-deterministic push-down automata, so we've seen that. We talked last time about the fact that there are context-sensitive languages, and here we're allowing rules with general stuff on the left or right-hand side. Only this curious length restriction, that the rule doesn't decrease the length of what you've got. And as we're going to see today, some new stuff, there's a kind of machine associated with those called linear bounded automata, if you use the non-deterministic flavor of them. And if you have these grammar rules without any restriction at all, you get unrestricted or general grammars, and they correspond to the class of what are also called recursively enumerable languages. So that's another name for the top level for the Chomsky hierarchy, and they're recognized by other stuff we're going to talk about called Turing machines. So the stuff in red is the kind of stuff we haven't done yet that we're going to talk about today. Okay, so that's a kind of important key slide. Right, so I noted last time that we had this funny length restriction on context-sensitive rules, but I said that I wasn't really going to explain yesterday what the motivation for that restriction was, why that was an interesting or sensible restriction. So let me attempt to kind of convey the intuition for that. So the idea is that if we've got a context-sensitive grammar where all the rules obey this restriction, and we've got any derivation for a string where you where you start from the start symbol and you expand it to various sentential forms and you end up with the string you're interested in, because none of the rules allow you to decrease the length of what you've got, they can only increase the length or keep it the same, that means that all the intermediate forms that you'll get in the course of this derivation must have length at most the length of S. You can't have anything longer than S, because then you'd need to shorten something to get back down to S. So what that means is that if our language is context sensitive, and we're trying, and we've got some string S, and we're trying to decide whether or not S is in the language, what that means is we only need to think about possible sentential forms, so possible intermediate steps in the derivation, that have length at most the length of S. Okay, so there's a bound on the length of the sentential forms we ever need to think about. So intuitively, that means that at least in some theoretical sense, we have the problem under control. There's only a kind of bounded amount of stuff we need to look at. So we know that if we keep looking for long enough, we'll be able to answer the question whether S is in the language. By contrast, supposing we think about completely general grammars where you don't have this length restriction, then even for quite a short string, little s, okay, there's no limit in advance you can put on the length of the intermediate forms that might come up in the derivation of S. So even if your string S is five symbols long, okay, there might be a derivation which kind of expands the start symbol to something with 273 symbols, and then shrinks it back down to 39 symbols, and then expands it to 8,195 symbols, and then shrinks it back down to five symbols. Okay, so it's wild, it's out of control, we've no idea. If we're trying to look for, derivations of this string, we've no idea when we can stop looking and say, no, there aren't any. Okay, it's a kind of, there's something about context-sensitive grammars that's under control because of this length restriction, but that's out of control and wild because if we don't have the length restriction. So that's the intuitive difference. And we'll see this that made a bit more precise as we proceed. Okay. This is roughly why this is an interesting or sensible or worthwhile restriction to think about. Okay. So now let me tell you about Turing machines. Incidentally, this thing about length being out of control, that's related to another thing. There's another phenomenon which turns out to be quite closely related to this, which is that in maths, right, you can have a very short theorem with a very long proof, okay? So think about Fermat's last theorem, okay? So there's no x integers, positive integers, x, y, z, and n greater than 2, such that x to the n plus y to the n plus z to the n equals z to the n, right, okay? Nice short statement, okay? Andrew Wiles, about 10 or 15 years ago, came up with a 130-page proof of it, okay? And that was building on lots and lots of other people's work. So given that, that's why maths is hard, right? Because you can have a short statement. There's no upper limit to the length, to how far afield you might have to look to find a proof of it. And you can't announce just because you've tried looking for a proof and you haven't found one, that therefore there isn't one. Okay, so it's a very closely related thing. So maths too is wild and out of control, right? In the same way that these general context, general languages are out of control. And in fact, we'll maybe see next time that is actually, in a theoretical point of view, that is actually the same problem. It's actually the same reason behind it. Okay. Okay. So Okay, so let me tell you what a Turing machine is. So Turing machines are going to be a general kind of computing device. And they're going to be more powerful than the kinds of device we've seen before, because they're going to be more generous in the sort of use of memory that they support. Okay, so you'll remember that NFAs or DFAs, in some sense, they're essentially memoryless. Okay, they're in any moment, they're in one of a finite number of states. So at least they kind of remember what state they're in, we hope. But they can't kind of store anything anywhere else to look at it later. So they're essentially work just on the basis of the current state they're in, without any kind of memory. I've heard that, this is a digression, there are certain kinds of lizards, right, such that, which don't have very much memory in the following sense. So if you take a circular plate, okay, and you arrange five lizards or so around, or let's make it six, right, it doesn't matter, around the edge, or facing around in a circle. This is a kind of program to play follow my leader, right, when they're searching for food or something. So if you do that, start them off, they will just follow each other round and round and round, and they'll keep doing it until they starve, because they don't have the processing power to spot, hang on, we've been here before, this isn't getting us anywhere, let's try something else. So they're kind of like essentially memoryless devices or something like that. So they're lizards in terms of their computing power will be quite low down on the Chomsky hierarchy. So it's just I don't know, I like things like that. where was I? Yeah, okay, so think of finite state machines as essentially memoryless, and pushdown automata, they do have memory, but in the restricted form of a stack, so we're rather restricted in the ways we can use it, because we can only access the top item of the stack. But now let's look at a different kind of machine that allows for a more general manipulation of memory. Okay, so just as before, we had, in the case of pushdown automata, remember we had a control unit which can have a finite number of internal states, so that's the thing that's controlling it. And we've got some memory available here. Only in this case, rather than a stack, we've got a long tape, okay, with individual cells, and let's imagine it extends infinitely far in both directions. So we've got access to an unlimited amount of memory, okay? And each cell on this tape can, in principle, contain a symbol drawn from a finite alphabet. So just as in pushdown automata, we had a stack alphabet for things that can go on the stack. So here I've got a tape alphabet, and here I've assumed I can write certain ASCII characters on this tape, okay? Now the same as, similarly to pushdown automata, we've got a head that reads a current position of this tape. So the idea is that this control unit can, at a given time, see just the symbol that's written on the cell that's in front of it. But in contrast to pushdown automata, this can both read and write to the current cell position, and the thing can also issue instructions to move the whole tape one place to the left or one place to the right. Okay, so we're not constrained to use it just in a certain order like a stack. We can scan backwards and forwards through memory, sort of scrolling this tape as much as we like either way. Okay. So you might think this is a kind of pretty crummy way to model memory. You know, why not sort of use memory addresses like everyone else does? If you think about it, if we've got an infinite amount of memory, then memory addresses are going to be a bit of a problem, because you might need an arbitrarily large number even to specify the address or the address of a cell in memory. And then the question arises, well, where do you write that and how do you access that? So in a way, you might as well stick with this very crude and sort of low-budget thing of just scrolling a tape where you scroll things one way or another. Sorry? Oh, right. Yeah, you can have it either So here I've had it infinite in both directions. In some versions you'll have you could make it just infinite in one direction. In principle, that wouldn't make any difference. There are lots of minor variations you'll see in the definition of Turing machines that don't, in principle, make a difference to what you can and can't do with it. Okay, so here I've taken one in infinite in both directions, but that's a good example of a minor detail that's not really important in principle. Okay, so these were kind of thought of by Alan Turing around about 1936, and they're kind of historically important because this was kind of before computers as we now know them really existed. So there were particular kind of calculating engines that did addition and multiplication when you turned the handle, kind of clever things like that. But this was the first time that anyone came up with the concept of a general purpose computing device that you could, in some sense, program and make it perform any computing task you wanted. So this is where the kind of theoretical idea of a general purpose computer first arose. And in the years following Turing's paper, Turing himself was one of the first people who worked on actually building physical general-purpose computers. And of course, they were then things that occupied a whole room with lots of valves and things, and very hard to program. But still, this is kind of where computers came from, so it's not historically important. Okay. So what's this thing supposed to do? So at each stage, so just as with pushdown automata, we think of a computation as proceeding in steps, and what happens at each step can depend on two things. First of all, the internal state that this control unit is in, and secondly, the symbol that it can see on the tape in front of it. Okay. So what happens at each stage can depend on these two pieces of information. And depending on those, various things can happen. Okay, so the machine can, if it wants, it can then overwrite the current tape symbol that it's just read with some other symbol. So this head, tape head here, is both a read and a write head. It can write write to the cell it sees in front of it, and then it can issue an instruction to shift the whole tape left or right by one cell, and then it can jump to a new internal control state. Okay, so it's acting kind of locally on the basis of what it sees in front of it, but because it's able to scroll through the tape, it can effectively make use of this unlimited amount of memory in front of it. Okay. So this is a description of what happens in a single computation step, and then when we're in a single, after we've done that step, we're in a new state here, and we may have a new symbol in front of us here. So we do it again, and we just go through steps like that repeatedly. And let's say that when the control unit enters some final state, state that's tagged as the final state, then it stops, and that's game over, and we declare that it's reached the end of the computation. So that's the idea of what a Turing machine is. It's not too complicated. Okay. So suppose we want to use this Turing machine as a device for testing membership of some language. So supposing we've got some set of strings over an alphabet sigma, how would we use a Turing machine to test membership of a set of strings? So first of all, let's assume that our alphabet we've got a Turing machine where a tape alphabet gamma, which contains our string alphabet sigma. So we're allowed to write symbols from the string alphabet on the tape, and we may also be allowed to write other stuff as well, but at least any sentences in this thing can be written in a language. And let's set up the tape with our test string written left to right on the input tape with the head at the read position. So let's say we've got hello. Okay. And let's suppose we also set things up so that we've got some blank symbol that appears everywhere else on the tape. So we can detect when we're end of this string because we come to the blank symbol, okay, which we'll assume isn't in sigma itself. Okay. So then you can start off your Turing machine in that configuration and in some initial state of the control unit, and then just let it run and see if it enters the final state. And at any point, if it enters the final state, you then declare that it's accepted this string, okay? So that can be our notion of an accepting computation, okay? So just as a DFA or a pushdown automaton will define a language by the set of strings that it accepts, so a Turing machine in this way can be used to define a language. So given any Turing machine T, we can write the L of T for the language consisting of strings that are accepted by this Turing machine, in the sense that starting off with that string, it'll eventually get us to this final state. Okay? So it's a theorem, to connect this up with the Chomsky hierarchy, that a set of strings is the language generated by some unrestricted grammar. That's a grammar at the top level of the Chomsky hierarchy. If and only if there's some Turing machine T such that L is the language accepted by T. So in other words, the languages that can be described by Turing machines this way are exactly no more, no less than the languages that can be described by unrestricted or type zero grammars. So we've got the kind of matching up between machines and grammars, the kind that we had at other levels of the Chomsky hierarchy. Okay, so another name for this class of languages you get from either of these two approaches is the class of recursively enumerable languages. Right. Okay, so we'll maybe say a bit more about next time about where that name comes from. Okay? So we can be a bit more formal about what a Turing machine is. I've given the idea, but if you want to give it in a sort of more mathematical style, you can say, there's rather a lot of bits and pieces, but we've got a set Q of control states. One of them's labeled as the initial state, and then let's say we've got one which we pick out as the final state, or the accepting state, and we've got a tape alphabet gamma, and the input alphabet for the strings, that will be some subset sigma of gamma. And then we need to identify a blank symbol, which I've written the minus sign, and that's a symbol that's in gamma, but not in sigma. And then the important bit here is the transition function. So this tells us what the machine is to do at each given step. So at a given step where the control state is an element, a state in Q, and the currently read tape symbol is an element of a symbol in gamma. So given these two things, the function delta will tell us the new control state to jump to, the new tape symbol to write on that cell that we're looking at, and then a choice of L or R, which will tell us whether to shift the tape left or right at that step. Okay. So given these data, this gives a mathematical description of what I informally described to you earlier. And as I said, there are lots of minor variations. You can have a tape that's infinite in one direction or both directions. You can have Turing machines with several tapes, one for the input, another one for output, and one for scratch working. Lots and lots of different, if you look in, probably no two books will have exactly the same definition of Turing machine, but anything in this kind of ballpark you would call a Turing machine. And they all turn out to be equivalent in terms of their computational power, in the sense that each of them could in principle simulate any of the others. Okay. So given all this stuff, we could in principle be then mathematically define what we mean by an accepting computation. So we could get a sequence of machine configurations and tape configurations to describe the way computation progresses for a string. So we'll take it as read that we could do all that formally, but at this stage of the term, I couldn't really be bothered, and don't suppose you'd mind if I don't do it. So just I mean, this can all be made quite mathematically rigorous, but I won't bother. Okay, so that's Turing machines, and that kind of deals with the top level of the Chomsky hierarchy. But now let's restrict our model a little bit to allow not an infinite tape, but just a finite tape. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take a tape that's just long enough to write. So I'm again thinking of using machines to test some input string. So I think we give ourselves a tape that's just long enough to write the input string that we want to test. Okay. And we surround it with start and end markers either way, so that we can, so that our machine can tell whether it's reached the end of them. And then that's all the tape we're allowed. So as it were, we're restricting the kind of memory use that we're allowing ourselves. Okay? So we can, so our computation can read this input. It can overwrite these symbols if it likes with other stuff while it's doing working, but it can't use any more space than is allotted to it by this length of tape. That might still be quite a lot of space, of course, because our input alphabet gamma, we're just saying gamma is a finite alphabet, but it might be a very large finite alphabet, so even a single symbol on this tape could, in some sense, record quite a lot of information. But but the main point is that we're allowing an amount of information that's merely proportional to the length of the input string. Okay, and if you do that, we'll call it a linear bounded automaton, for the obvious reason that the amount of memory available is bounded by a linear function of the length of the input. So sometimes you might see alternative definitions of LBAs where the tape length isn't actually the length of the input string, but it's bounded by some constant multiple of the input string. So you'd be allowed, say, you fix on a constant like 5, and then you say, well, you'd be allowed a tape of length 5 times the length of the input string, but no longer than that. Again, doesn't really matter because it doesn't make any difference in principle to what we can do with such a machine. And this is, we may as well stick with this nice simple thing, okay? So that's a restriction of Turing machines called linear bounded automata. And again, we've got a theorem which says that a language is context sensitive if and only if it's recognized by some linear bounded automaton. There's a little subtlety here, because here it seems we have to work with the non-deterministic version of linear bounded automata. So I haven't given you this definition here was the definition of a Turing machine that behaved deterministically, right? Because my transition function here, for any given set of data here, there's only one thing it could jump to. But you could easily imagine by analogy with the definition of NFAs what a non-deterministic Turing machine would be like. So we can easily allow ourselves the notion of a non-deterministic linear bounded automaton. And the theorem is that context-sensitive languages correspond precisely to what can be recognized with non-deterministic linear bounded automata. Okay. So there's no restriction on the kind of order in which we can access memory. They're more generous than push-down automata in that respect. But there is a restriction on the amount of memory that we're allowed. So you can get the rough idea behind this theorem. So this goes back to the idea that in a derivation for a string, we never need to use an intermediate form that's longer than the length of s. So any intermediate form that came up in a derivation, there would be room to write on this tape. So the idea is that we kind of just guess, because we're non-deterministic, we can take advantage of our ability to magically guess the steps in a derivation, and we just check them one by one, writing each intermediate form on this tape, and just checking that it follows from the previous one. So that's the idea of how you would prove at least one half of this theorem here. Okay. So again, we've got a tie-up between a certain class of grammars and a certain class of machines. Okay. Just a little curiosity to tie up about this little question whether we should be working with non-deterministic or deterministic machines. Okay, so it's just a bit odd. If you always work with non-deterministic ones, you're fine. Okay, so if you're in doubt, work with non-deterministic ones. But let's just see what the situation is. So we saw at the start of the course that at the level of regular languages, it doesn't make any difference because any non-deterministic finite automaton can be simulated by a deterministic one. Okay, so at this level, deterministic and non-deterministic have the same power. Okay, and at the very top level, the level Turing machines we've just been talking about, I've given a deterministic version of Turing machines, but you could equally well give a non-deterministic one, and again, it would turn out that a non-deterministic Turing machine can, in principle, be simulated by a deterministic one. Roughly the idea is the same. We kind of track all possible computation paths of the non-deterministic one in parallel and just keep track of all possibilities. So but the top and the bottom level, that's not a big deal whether you're deterministic or not. We mentioned earlier in the course that at the context-free level, it does make a difference. So you need to be working with non-deterministic machines in order to account to get all context-free languages, because at this level, at the level of pushdown automata, non-deterministic machines are strictly more powerful than deterministic ones. And I can now say a little bit about why that's true. This is just a sort of academic footnote, really. It's not too important. But you see, this little language here, This language here, which consists of all strings except the strings which consist of the same string twice, okay? That turns out to be a context-free language. But I mentioned at the end of last lecture that this language here, the set of duplicated strings, SS, that's not a context-free language. So we've got a context-free language here whose complement isn't context-free, okay? Okay, now I claim that that shows that this context-free language can't be the language recognized by any deterministic pushdown automata. Because if you had a deterministic pushdown automaton that recognizes its language, a given language, then, so if L is any language recognized by a deterministic PDA, then its complement of L would also be recognized by a deterministic PDA, because roughly speaking, in a deterministic setting, you can just swap accepting and non-accepting states, and you'll get a recognizer for just the complement. So that's, if you fill in the details, that's a little example that shows this language here can be is context-free, and so it can be recognized by an NPDA, but not by any DPDA. So what about the remaining level, the context-sensitive level, which is where we were at the moment? So are non-deterministic linear bounded automata strictly more powerful than deterministic ones, or not? So actually, no one knows. This question's been around, a few decades now. It's still an open problem. So one would conjecture, it would be generally believed that the answer's yes. So it's similar to what happens at the context-free level. One would conjecture that there are things you can do with the non-deterministic ones that you can't do with any deterministic one. But no one's managed to prove that. So if anyone fancies a sort of interesting little exercise over the Christmas holidays, then let me know if you get anywhere with it. I'm delighted to discuss it. Okay. Right. So now let's go back to this intuitive idea I talked about at the beginning of where the length restriction comes from, and about the problem of telling whether something isn't in a given language. Okay. So supposing we've got a linear bounded automaton, okay, and we can use that to detect that certain strings, supposing it corresponds to some language, we can use that to detect that certain strings are in a language, because eventually we'll get to some final state and then we'll say yes. But how might we use those to detect that a string isn't in the language, okay? So the problem is that you might your linear bounded automaton by itself isn't going to do that for you, because you might set it up with the string and it might compute and compute and compute, and you sit there waiting for it to stop. But how do you know if it's ever going to stop? Okay, it might just keep going forever. Do you have a way of telling whether it's ever going to stop? Because if it's never going to stop, then you can, if you know it's never going to stop, then you know it's never going to reach a final state, then you know your string's not in the language. But how can you know a thing like that? Okay? So, first thing to notice is that if there's some accepting computation, in other words, if there's a computation that does lead us to a final state, then there would be one that didn't pass through exactly the same machine configuration twice. By machine configuration here, I mean both the control state of the machine and the contents of the tape. So the state of the entire device is the same twice. That's a silly thing, because if there's a computation like that, you could just shorten it by missing out the bit in between the two identical states. Anything you'll be allowed to do from the first one, you'll be allowed to do from the second one. So we can assume, if there's an accepting computation, we can assume there's an accepting computation that doesn't go through the same state twice. So it's like, if we notice that our machine has gone through the same state twice, we can abort it, okay? Because we're only looking for non-repeating computations that lead to a final state. So because we know that there must be a non-repeating computation if there's an accepting computation at all. Now, because in the LBA case, our tape is finite, the total number of machine configurations that there are at all, okay, is itself finite. We've got finitely many symbols in each cell, and a finite number of cells, and a finite number of positions the read head can be at, and a finite number of control states. So everything's finite. So the total number of machine configurations is in principle finite, although probably very large, right, because it's exponential. So in theory, if a machine runs for long enough without reaching the final state, because there are only finitely many possible configurations, in theory, it'll have to eventually re-enter the same configuration twice. Okay, in that case, we may as well abort it. This is it's kind of gone into a loop. Okay, so Right, so notice here, it's not the machine itself that's spotting that it's gone to the same state, same configuration twice. But think of it as it's us looking on who've made a note of all the configurations it's been through, and we spot, been there before. You know, we're not going to play the lizard game anymore. We're going to jump out at this point. Okay, so because we can detect repeated states, that means we can use that to detect when a sentence is not in the language, because if a sentence is not in the language, then even in the non-deterministic case, every computation path will eventually take us to a state we've been through before. And if we see that that's the case, then we can say we're not in the language. Okay. So us watching, or perhaps some super machine spying on T, can detect that S isn't in this language, if indeed it isn't. So we can, in principle, always tell one way or another whether or not S is going to be accepted by this LBA. So that's for LBAs, and that again comes back to the idea that things are finite and under control here. But for Turing machines with an unlimited tape space, this reasoning doesn't work, because there are, in principle, we've got unlimited amount of memory at our disposal. There are, in principle, infinitely many machine configurations we can go through. We don't know how much of the tape the computation might be used before it's going to terminate. So the natural question arises, is there some general way of spotting that a Turing machine computation isn't going to terminate? Okay, can we, looking on, somehow, say, detect that the machine's in some way got into some kind of loop or something? Can we? Is there a way we can always spot that it's not going to terminate? And that's a fundamental question, really, about the nature of computation, and will be answered next lecture. There's a clue in the title of the next lecture, which is undecidability. Right, okay, so that might give you a hint as to which way this is going to go. Okay? Right, okay, so that's the fundamental difference between these two levels. Okay. So just kind of as a prelude to the next lecture, some comments on sort of the wider significance and interest of the Turing machine model. So one reason Turing machines are interesting and important is because, at least it's generally, there's a general belief that there's an idea around that anything that you can do at all using any kind of mechanical procedure or algorithm. And by mechanical procedure here, I intuitively mean some kind of operation you can perform just by following rules, okay? So you know, you know lots of algorithms you can perform where, as it were, once you understand the rules, you can just slavishly apply them. You don't need to use any kind of creative thought or, you know, make any decisions yourself. You're just following instructions. So there's an intuitive idea of things that can be done mechanically, in other words, without any insight or creativity, just by following rules. And so the idea is that computers themselves are mechanical devices in this sense. They're just kind of slavishly doing things according to rules we understand. So there's a question about what in principle can and can't be done by mechanical procedures. Okay, so it's believed, and I mean almost universally believed here, that in some sense anything that can be done by any mechanical procedure or algorithm whatsoever can in principle be done by this humble Turing machine that's just shunting symbols around, putting single symbols on tape and shunting tape backwards and forwards. Okay, so even the most complex computer system or programming language that we know today, okay, could in principle, okay, be simulated on this clunky little Turing machine, okay, with infinite amount of tape in either directions, if you allow it kind of, you know, billions and billions of years to kind of simulate stuff. So two examples of what that would mean is that, so in the context of language theory, so first of all, any language that can be recognized by some mechanical procedure. So if we've got any kind of intuitively mechanical recipe for accepting a string when it's in the language, for recognizing a string whenever it's in the language, then that can in principle be simulated on a Turing machine. That's the idea. Well, likewise, any mathematical function, so let's say function on the natural numbers, any function that you can compute at all by a mechanical recipe can in principle be computed by a Turing machine. And here I'm thinking of, we can, for example, write numbers in binary, or decimal for that matter. Okay, we can write numbers of arbitrary size, and that's a blank symbol there, on Turing machine tape. So we can set up a Turing machine with our input number written on the tape and require that the machine itself writes the output number onto the tape before it quits. Okay. And so if you look at the class of mathematical functions that can be computed by Turing machines in that way, the idea is that covers anything that can be computed by any known mechanical computational procedure. So this idea, this claim that Turing machines, as it were, cover the limit, capture the limits of what can be done by mechanical procedures in general, this is often known as the Church-Turing thesis. So it's not a theorem as such. It's a somewhat informal statement in so far as we've got a precise definition of Turing machines, but we haven't given a precise formal definition of what we mean by a mechanical procedure. Okay. So here I'm appealing to your intuitive understanding of, or your experience of following rules. I'm appealing to your intuitive understanding of what a kind of rule-like mechanical procedure is. So we have a pretty good idea of what we mean by this, and we have the feeling that we'd recognize a mechanical procedure when we saw one. Okay. So there's a certain amount of philosophical nitpicking you can go into here, and one can distinguish subtly different versions of this Church-Turing thesis. And it's quite depending on whether we're talking about kind of, you know, algorithms that a mathematician could understand, or whether we're talking about what a physical device could perform, or whatever. At any rate, the broad idea behind the Church-Turing thesis is generally accepted. No one really expects to find what something that we would all agree to be a mechanical procedure that can't be captured by a Turing machine. And at the very least, even if we disregard time and memory limitations on present-day computers, anything that can be done on any sort of computer that we have at the moment, or have any idea how to build using of our current understanding of physics and so forth, could in principle be done on a Turing machine. Okay. So this is a rather philosophical claim rather than a mathematical theorem, but nevertheless, it's kind of strong support for it. And if you buy into this Church-Turing thesis idea, then that means that mathematical theorems you can prove about what Turing machines can and can't do can be interpreted as sort of as fundamental theorem statements about the limits of what can and can't be done by mechanical computation in general. Okay, if you believe that what Turing machines can do coincide exactly with what mechanical procedures in general can do, whatever they are, okay, then if you can prove that Turing machines can't do such and such, that kind of tells you that there's no mechanical procedure, at least of any kind that we currently have any idea how to envisage, that would do such and such. Okay, so such theorems are kind of interesting because they seem to have some fundamental significance about the limits of computation itself, in some sense. So we'll see some examples next time of limitative theorems about what you can't do with Turing machines, and hence, if you buy into the Church Turing thesis, what you can't do by mechanical computation at all. So that's next time. Okay, I've finished early again. Okay.
About types and type raising.
Type raising?
Oh, yeah. As it relates to our assignment.
Ah, okay, go on.
So, my understanding so far is the type of a function which takes, for example, two integers as arguments and gives the results of a Boolean.
Mm-hmm.
So, when we have this function with both arguments included, its type is a Boolean, right?
The type of the function itself would be...
No, the function, once we give it the arguments...
Right, so we've got an f, okay, which itself has type, let's say, integer arrow, that's the type of the function, the function is of f itself, yeah.
But then if we...
F of 5 of 3...
Yeah. So when with type raising, what we're doing is actually changing, raising the type of these elementary things to something more complicated.
And type raising may be a bit of a red herring because type raising comes into the natural language semantics part of this course.
But in an example, for example, of an NP going to the terminal N, for example.
Yeah.
My first intuition would be that N has somehow a more basic meaning, like the terminal as well. But then what we do with type raising is raise this to be actually a first order function, rather than a simple meaning. Right?
Yes. So you can encode such, you can play such tricks within this language. So for example, you could raise. So the sort of analogous thing to type raising here would be rather than representing n as an integer in a naive way, think about integer arrow bool. So this is like takes a property of integers and tells you whether it's true of the number you have in mind. So I could write that as sort of. Yeah. Let's say I'll call it raise 5, okay, of p, but p is of this type, is p of 5, okay, would be a way of writing it. So raise 5 would have this type, that's the kind of type raise type of the number 5. So rather than think about just the number 5, you think about a thing that takes properties of numbers to whether 5 have that. Has that property. So you can use that. In fact, you can even write a function raise. I don't know. Is this helping them?
Yeah.
Right, okay. You can even write a function raise which takes an integer and then type raises it. And this would be simply raise n p equals p applied to n. So, this is a second order function.
It's worth thinking about just to get an intuition for what you can do with this type of system.
Yeah,
but it's like if you can do it in Haskell. I mean, it's all. It's worth making the mental connection between this type raising stuff and natural language semantics and the types you get in Haskell programs.
For example, does this relate to our assignment? The function of less than, for example. But once we know the integers, so something like c pre less than 5, the function
that has type bool.
All right. Then I think
You could go into the Haskell interpreter.
GH, is it the Glasgow Haskell interpreter you've been using?
I think if you just go into that and type something like 3 less than 5, it will not only tell you true, but it will tell you that it has type bool. So you can use the Haskell interpreter as a way of experimenting to see what types things are supposed to have, if it helps.
Because there was the way we interpreted in the assignment, the way we interpreted an expression of this kind will actually have type 2, right?
So this arrow only occurs in expressions for types, not for types. So you have
T arrow T prime, where T is the prime type, rather than. So on the type.
The best thing I can say is, I think if you've got.
If you've got a definition like f of n equals n plus 1, then just f itself is type. Is zero integer. F of 3 is type. That's kind of all there is to say. I mean if you think of F itself as an entity in its own right, as opposed to. So functions are things in it they sort of exist as things in their own right, not just as things applied to arguments. So
this is why we have this arrow type as opposed to having a simple class.
It's just that f is a function, right? But f of 3 is a number.
This may be the example we have on the Turing machine. Converting decimal.